We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. Well, let's begin with local news, starting with Archbishop Peter Sartain. Who is Archbishop Peter Sartain?
Archbishop Peter Sartain is an archbishop, surprisingly enough, I believe it's Western Washington, the Washington Diocese. He came out here in 2010 from Illinois and has been much in the news lately. A couple different issues this week in which he made national news. One was the announcement on Wednesday that the Vatican had chosen Sartain to lead, and this is a direct quote, a full-scale overhaul of the largest umbrella group for nuns in the United States, accusing it of, quote, taking positions that undermine Roman Catholic teaching on the priesthood and homosexuality while promoting certain radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith. You know, for instance, the right of women to vote and work in the workplace and, you know, wear shoes and that sort of thing. And so that was one of the reasons he was in the news this week. And it was very interesting to see that our own favorite left-wing rag, the Seattle Times, had him listed as, Sartain, a political moderate. Well, no, he's not a moderate. Number one, he's not a moderate if he's in favor with the Vatican, which he obviously is, given the nature of the Vatican. He's certainly not a favorite if they're using him as the attack dog to go after a group of nuns and accusing them of radical feminist themes, such as, the idea that women are actually human beings. But the other reason he was in the news this week is that he was requiring the different parishes in his archdiocese to read a letter from the pulpit and suggesting that they circulate to their members signature regarding Referendum 74, the referendum that opponents of gay marriage are trying to put on the ballot to repeal the gay marriage law that Governor Gregoire signed into effect a couple months ago. So the Catholic Church here is, specifically Sartain, is requiring that priests read letters from the pulpit denouncing this law and strongly suggesting that they circulate for signatures in the different churches, the petitions that would allow the initiative to get on the ballot. So far there have been six different churches in Western Washington, most of them in the Seattle area, who have refused to go along with this, openly defying their archbishop. And mind you, this is something where, you know, the Catholic Church is not a democracy. It's very much a hierarchy, as most people are aware. And they're not supposed to have a choice about this, but they are practicing what if it were the law, we would call civil disobedience. So I guess it's religious disobedience or whatever the term would be. So Our Lady of the Lake Catholic Church, St. James Cathedral, which is the largest church in the area, or the largest Catholic church in the area, St. Joseph Church, St. Mary's Church, St. Patrick Church, and Christ Our Hope Catholic Church have all refused, and they all deserve big props for that. Now these both have made the news, but one of the reasons why, another reason why Sartain is not exactly a clean image guy or a political moderate is the Seattle Times has never done a news story on what very well may be the reason he's in Seattle in the first place. He was transferred here in 2010 from Joliet, Illinois, diocese out there, and just before he left Joliet, he was involved in a major scandal involving Father Alejandro Flores, who was convicted in 2010 of a sexual assault charge relating to the abuse of an underage boy. I know, pick yourself up off the floor. Sartain, who was then the Bishop of Joliet, Illinois, ordained Flores in the summer of that year. And it was before the charges had been filed, but just a few months after church officials had found gay porn with young-looking boys on Flores' computer. So here we have a bishop promoted to archbishop by the U.S. Catholic bishops and by the Vatican when he's in the middle not of a decades-old sex scandal involving the abuse of underage boys, but one that was ongoing as late as 2010. This is our archbishop of here in Seattle, and he is now, not surprisingly, opposing the right of homosexuals to marry because, after all, he's in the priesthood. He can't marry, so why should anybody else? And besides, the males that he like are probably too young to marry. But you know, it really underscores that there's been almost no local media that has tried to hold this relatively powerful person accountable, not only for what he's doing right now around things like, you know, being a point person appointed by the Vatican to continue their recent surge of war on women type activity, and getting himself involved in local politics, trying to go after the rights of gays and lesbians to have marriage equality, but also for his relatively recent past, immediately predating his transfer out here. TV stations haven't covered it. The Seattle Times hasn't covered it. There's just been no accountability for it, and it really underscores how lame our local media often is in holding powerful people accountable in a local politics and culture.
Well, perhaps after this, there'll be some trickle-up effect.
One would hope. So, you know,
as we've seen from time to time,
tell a friend
fairly irregularly, but
particularly if your friend is, you know, an editor
or even a writer.
Yeah, I wish I knew any of those. Yeah.
All right. Anything else on our local archbishop?
I think that's more than enough.
All right. Let's move on then to a couple groups challenging trying to challenge the top two primary.
Well, they have been. Both the Democratic Party of Washington State and the Libertarian Party of Washington State, they and the state Republicans had all filed a lawsuit challenging the top two primary system that was implemented after the U.S. Supreme Court had overturned Washington State's previous open primary system. The state parties don't like it, of course, because they cannot control the nomination process. Smaller parties don't like it because it virtually guarantees that only Democrats and Republicans will make it into the final top two election in November, unless one of the major parties does not field a candidate in a particular race. But the Democrats and the Libertarians took the previous court challenge, which was rejected last year by the Washington State Supreme Court. They are now petitioning to the U.S. Supreme Court to review the case. And this is particularly egregious because the U.S. Supreme Court in the first place, remember, was the body that overturned Washington State's previous law, the open primary. And so the top two primary, while nobody particularly likes it, was crafted specifically to meet the U.S. Supreme Court's objections. So this is kind of a waste of time, and I'd be actually pretty surprised if the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear this case. Their composition has not changed a whole lot since they threw the open primary system out. But, if that's what the parties want to spend their money on, I suppose it's better that than, candidates or anything.
Hmm. All right. Moving on then to national and U.S. Senate GOP.
Yeah, well, this actually is a semi-local story as well, because there's already a case going on in the National Labor Relations Board involving a company called Noel Canning over in Yakima. The NLRB ordered the Canning company to engage in collective bargaining after it was stonewalling against employees who had, done the card drive and all the other hoops that you have to go through under U.S. law in order to try and get collective bargaining rights in a workplace. And Noel Canning is suing the NLRB over this, and the Senate GOP, the U.S. Senate GOP, decided to join this lawsuit. And the reason they did is that a couple of the commissioners on the National Labor Relations Board were appointed by President Obama using recess appointments. Now, folks may remember that the Senate GOP, as part of its ongoing campaign to not allow Obama to do anything during his 4-year term, have denied him the right to a number of his executive branch employees, not because they have any particular ideological qualms with any of these employees. A number of them were recommended by Senate committees with complete bipartisan support, and really have done nothing that would be considered ideologically objectionable. The ideologically objectionable thing about them is that they were nominated by President Obama, and they don't want to hand Obama anybody that he actually wants. The recess appointment tool, which was used by President Bush quite a bit during his presidency and is sort of a routine tool that presidents use, allows presidents to make appointments when Congress, and in this case the Senate, is not in session. What the Senate GOP did, even though they're the minority party, is convene pro forma sessions of the Senate every couple of days when it was not in session, with a minimum number of GOP senators in order to claim a quorum, and then claim that the Senate was in session and therefore the president could not make recess appointments. The White House challenged this policy. They went ahead and made the recess appointments. The full Senate is controlled by Democrats, who endorsed this process. And so now the GOP is suing, claiming that the recess appointments are unconstitutional and therefore anything the NLRB does is also unconstitutional, while it has these commissioners. This could be a very interesting constitutional case. And as I say, it does involve a semi-local company that is trying to prevent a union from coming into the shop. So it'll be an interesting one to follow.
Interesting. The NLRB, of course, has also been involved heavily with the Boeing and its, actions and
yeah, and the GOP has also fiercely criticized that and tried to blame Obama for it after the NLRB went after Boeing for moving production of some of its planes from the Puget Sound area to Charleston, South Carolina, specifically as punishment against the union, South Carolina, of course, being a right-to-work state, specifically as punishment against the unions here for striking. And they explicitly said, which is completely illegal, that they were punishing unions for exercising their right to strike. And the NLRB said, well, you know, that is such a clear and open case of retaliatory laying off of people for union activity, which is blatantly illegal, we have no choice but to go after them for this. And they were including Republican appointees who were saying this. Nonetheless, the GOP, as they are wont to do, trying to blame Obama for it. And so the NLRB has already been fairly controversial for Washington state-related reasons over the last couple of years.
All right. Well, let's move on. Moving on to Boston and a case there involving a gentleman, Tarek Mihana.
Tarek Mihana, yeah, he is a young man who, converted Muslim, who was sentenced to 17 and a half years this week for advocating jihad. Now, the problem with this is that he didn't do anything else other than advocate jihad. He never went to a terrorist training camp in the Middle East somewhere. He never actually plotted anything. He never had any contact with any other people who were plotting anything. Even under the extremely far-reaching laws and the extremely far-reaching interpretations of laws that have been going on since 9/11, he didn't actually do anything. Prosecutors went after him anyway, using, various, post 9/11 laws. And, he basically was convicted for what he said, not for anything else. Which is just a real First Amendment case, and a number of the jurors said they were very troubled by this aspect of it, but the way that the judge sort of framed the questions didn't really give them any choice but to proceed with a conviction. He got 17 and a half years in prison for that this week. Meanwhile, Ted Nugent is basically calling for the assassination of Barack Obama and threatening to do it himself and getting away with it, suggesting that the First Amendment is still alive and well if you're extremely wealthy, politically well-connected, say on the board of the National Rifle Association, and very, very rich. But that if you are poor and young and Muslim, you really kind of have to watch what you say anymore. It's a very, very, Mahana is not a particularly sympathetic character. He did have a website where he was cheerleading for jihad and saying a number of things most people would find pretty objectionable. But that's how precedents for this sort of interpretation of the law are set. They go after the most objectionable cases first, where people would say, "Ooh, that's kind of, I don't agree with that." Well, the point isn't whether you agree with what he says. The point is whether he has a right to say it. And he does, clearly, under the Constitution. And then we lost that this week.
Okay, and I missed the first part. Was this a regular jury or a grand jury?
It's a regular jury in Boston.
Okay. All right. Moving on, TransCanada.
Yeah, TransCanada, there are the fine corporate folks who are digging up half of North Alberta and using what they find there to, first of all, cook the planet. But beyond that, to bring us, hopefully, by their standards anyway, the XL pipeline through the midsection of the country. The XL pipeline was delayed in its permitting process by the Obama administration earlier this year, primarily after pressure from the Republican governors of several Midwestern states, particularly Nebraska, over environmental concerns there. The original route of the pipeline went through the environmentally sensitive Sand Hills in the west part of the state. Well, TransCanada came out with a new route for the pipeline this week that would take it through eastern Nebraska instead, an area that avoids the Sand Hills but still threatens contamination of the Oglala Aquifer. That aquifer is what provides water for the farmlands pretty much from the Dakotas all the way to the Texas Panhandle, a huge section of the Great Plains agricultural midsection depends on the aquifer. That would still be a problem. The other problem with this, of course, is that eastern Nebraska is a lot more populated than western Nebraska is. There are a lot more farms there, particularly family farms. You don't have the large farms and ranches that you have in the western part of the state. And the concern about this, of course, it is going to be spun in the media and in elite political circles as a compromise that ought to satisfy everyone, when it in fact won't satisfy any environmentalists and shouldn't, and it probably shouldn't satisfy anybody in the state of Nebraska either, or in any other section of the country, in the Great Plains and whatnot, that's dependent on the Oglala Aquifer, or anybody else who cares about, say, the roasting of the planet. Nonetheless, it's going to be very interesting to see how this is spun as it goes forward, not just by TransCanada and their advocates, but also by politicians and mainstream media. And, oh yes, happy Earth Day.
Be interesting to, I'm sure it's come out already, about what percentage of our food comes from that aquifer.
Yeah, it's a fairly large percentage, actually. Not so much of things like fruits, but certainly grains. A lot of wheat, a lot of other grains. Beans are grown there.
All right. Well, you mentioned the Texas Panhandle. Texas Monthly came out with some information this week.
Oh, yes. A guy named Joe Hagan wrote a very interesting article for the new edition of Texas Monthly that harkened back to the story that percolated up in the early part of last decade regarding then-President George W. Bush and his service in the Vietnam War era in the Texas and Alabama National Guards. Now, he originally got a very cushy assignment in the Texas National Guard that was essentially reserved for children of wealthy Texas politicians. John Connolly's son was in it, and Lloyd Benson's son, and several other people like that. But then he was deployed to Alabama, and there was no evidence that he ever either showed up or completed his tour, even though he was there in the first place to avoid having to be shipped off to Vietnam the way not politically well-connected, wealthy young men of that era were being forced to do. And if you remember back in, I think it was 2003, somewhere in there, Dan Rather basically had his career destroyed at CBS over a report on that story, and a document that later turned out to be a forgery, although it was or alleged to be a forgery, although it was never really clear where the forgery came from and whether it was a mistake by CBS or whether it was a dirty trick by Karl Rove and his allies. That being said, the story that Joe Hagan did in Texas Monthly this week, which is an exhaustive investigative piece that he'd apparently spent some time on, basically said that, you know what, Dan Rather was right. Bush never did complete his service. He did skip out even on his minimal obligations, and he went back and interviewed a lot of the people from that era and a lot of the witnesses to it, and makes a pretty conclusive case on it. I would urge people to check it out. I mean, it's a shame that it's coming out now rather than, say, 9 years ago. But it's still, and it really does show, since all it took was this one guy with, essentially an alternative monthly magazine in Texas to dig this stuff up, how when it was the President of the United States, national networks had the resources to do exactly the same thing and never did. So once again, it seems to be a theme this week, powerful people being treated with kid gloves, and there's an excellent case of it.
Another example of alternative media doing the digging.
That's why we're here.
All right, moving on to international, starting with Iran.
Yeah, the first round of talks last weekend, it was actually just one day, happened in Istanbul, and all and this was the European Union and six powers and the United States and Iran, of course. All indications are that they went very well, and they scheduled a follow-up talks to be held, I believe, next month in Baghdad. The best indication that they went fairly well and were fairly constructive, and we talked last week about how Iran was setting signals ahead of those talks that they were willing to make compromises on both the amount and the sources of the enriched uranium that they used for their nuclear power development. The best indication of that was that the leaks that were coming out of the Obama administration and the White House regarding the talks were talking about how constructive the talks were. They were not talking, as almost all of the unattributed, anonymously sourced quotes from the U.S. government have been over, you know, at least the last decade, where they were not bellicose, they were not aggressive rhetoric, they were not talking about, you know, all options are on the table, that sort of thing. They were talking about how the talks were constructive. And we've talked a number of times on this show about how conciliatory gestures from Iran and offers to negotiate were not treated as serious offers, where offers were not pursued, were not honored, were not taken seriously, both by U.S. government officials and by media in this country. It seems like that is not the case in terms of what's happening with this round of talks. That's very encouraging, and it suggests that there's a possible, and I emphasize possible, light at the end of the tunnel about getting out of the confrontation over Iran's nuclear program without having either the United States or Israel actually attack Iran. If that manages to take place, it's going to be a real foreign policy feather in the cap of the Obama administration, because I think we have a pretty clear idea of what would have happened over the last 4 years if, say, John McCain had been president, how the quote-unquote negotiations with Iran would have been. There would be a third war in the region. Gas would be 10 bucks a gallon, et cetera. So, you know, the idea that the United States government can still pursue negotiation rather than launch a war first, ask questions later, is very, very encouraging, and let's hope it works out that way.
All right. Afghanistan.
Yeah, last Sunday, the Taliban launched a coordinated attack on multiple targets in Kabul, going after the Afghan parliament building, several embassies, NATO headquarters there, as I say, a number of very high-profile targets. And it emphasizes a couple of things. Number one, that they have the capacity to launch that kind of coordinated target on multiple, highly secure, supposedly, targets, which suggests that they've got a lot of inside information, a lot of collaborators among people who are in the security apparatus. Secondly, that, they're not exactly weak. This Kabul is the one part of the country where the Karzai government and the NATO powers supposedly have pretty good security, and obviously they don't. And it tells you how the whole heart and minds thing is coming along for Afghanistan. And it really underscores that the NATO mission there and the United States mission there, is not making progress. It's moving backwards. And, this again, as we keep saying, pretty much every time we utter the words Afghanistan, the sooner we get out of there, the better.
All right. Syria.
Yeah, protests yesterday, of course, Friday in the Muslim world being the day of prayer, and then also usually being the day of civil protests when those are happening. And it's become a tradition over the last year in Syria that there are protests, either large or small, depending on how many people the Syrian government is shooting that week. This past week, there were large protests again this week, and they were not targeting just the Syrian government, but they were also targeting the United Nations. The UN announcing this week that UN observers would not be circulated on Fridays, which is, of course, the day when most of the protests would have happened, when most of the violence from the government has taken place, and when most of the unarmed civilians have been shot. So the United Nations essentially playing chicken and avoiding the areas of greatest conflict with that decision. The other disturbing news in Syria this week is that the ceasefire, which has been very tentative since it was declared a couple of weeks ago, does not appear to be holding. Not only is the government continuing to shoot civilians there, but we also had a number of IED-type explosions, which, you know, could be planted by the government that could, which would then blame them on rebels, but it could also be some of the more violent factions of the resistance. Not a good sign in Syria this week.
All right. And Egypt.
Yeah. Just to follow up on that very briefly, since we've got a couple other stories also, massive, protests in Egypt yesterday as well over the ruling military, government there, unilaterally changing the conditions by which upcoming parliamentary elections will be held. Really the largest demonstrations there since, the fall of Mubarak and demonstrations that were supported not only by liberals, also by students, also by Islamists, you know, all the different opposition factions, coming together on this one. And, that issue is not going to go away either.
All right. And then UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon.
Yeah, more or less begging, which shows you how much relative power they have, President Obama this week to attend the Rio Plus 20 summit in Rio de Janeiro in June. Now, yes, in fact, the original Rio summit to deal with climate change was 20 years ago in June. 1992 was that first summit. And we still don't have any meaningful global action on climate change. And the United States is one of the countries most responsible for that lack of progress. And President Obama has not said one way or another whether he's going to attend that particular summit, but he has dropped a number of signals, and a number of administration officials have said he is leaning against it, which is very, very, and, you know, the rationale obviously being that during an election year, he doesn't want to give the Republicans any more ammunition by, say, acknowledging that climate change exists, which really shows you how cockeyed politics in the United States has become. But the fact that he would not attend that summit, or even the prospect that he's considering not attending it, let alone favoring that course of action, very, very disturbing.
All right, and then very quickly, France.
Yeah, France going to the polls tomorrow in their first round of voting for the first presidency. Polls show the incumbent conservative president, Nicolas Sarkozy, losing once the runoff election happens to the other leader in the polling for tomorrow in the polls, the socialist candidate, François Hollande. If so, it would be the first major European power to have a socialist leader in a while. The three main ones, France, Germany, and Great Britain, all have conservative leaders right now. So it would be a move back in the other direction that would be pretty significant, not just for French politics, but also for European politics. So that's worth keeping an eye on.
All right. And events.
Several events coming up this week. This morning, and it already started an hour ago, but it's going on another couple of hours. Nicholsville is having a fundraiser, a pancake breakfast. That's by donation, however much you want to donate. So if you want to donate $5 for breakfast, fine. $1,000 will be acceptable too. That'll be at Hope and Is right now at Hope Lutheran School in Southwest Seattle at 4456 42nd Avenue Southwest. Also today at 4 o'clock, Mothers for Police Accountability is hosting its annual Paul Robeson Peace and Justice Awards celebration. That'll be at the Central Area Senior Center, 530th Avenue South, over there on the bluff overlooking Lake Washington. Both today and tomorrow, there's a self-guided green home tour, that you can do all by yourself. The place where you would go to pick up the information on it is Puget Sound Solar. That's at 5308 Baker Avenue Northwest. I believe that's in Ballard. Tomorrow, of course, being Earth Day, one day down, 364 to go. There are a number of different events on Earth Day going on around the town, and the City of Seattle government website has a pretty good rundown of what a lot of those different celebrations are. And then on Tuesday and Wednesday, the 24th and 25th of April, starting at noon on the 24th and going for 24 hours, there's going to be an Occupy CEHKC demonstration. CEHKC is the Committee to End Homelessness in King County, part of the 10-year plan to end homelessness, which is now, I think it's on like year 15. No, actually, it's only year 7, but they're making great progress. The It's going to be an overnight encampment in Westlake Park to draw attention to it and leafleting people and so forth. Then at 7:30 on Wednesday morning, the 25th, there's going to be a march to City Hall. And at 8:30 in City Hall, the CEHKC governing board is going to be meeting, and folks are going to be attending and perhaps making, just perhaps making their presence known at that.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And you can check that out. Also, when Maria is back here, we might remember to plug that her writing also appears frequently at mariatomchick.com.